Good morning. This is a great crowd for a rainy Sunday. I just automatically assume people stay home, sleep in. But, you know, I was talking this past week with somebody, and I don't even remember who it was, but we were talking about how when we were out those couple weeks, when we got back together, you could tell people desired community. Like, you miss being with your people. And it took me back to COVID, when we were so separated during COVID, and how that really affected a lot of people. But I'm thankful that you are here, and I'm thankful that you're my people. And I'm thankful that I'm hopefully your people, and that we're here to worship God together. We're going to continue, finish up our series today in the book of Daniel. Bear with me today. I think I have a sinus infection now. I just can't get over all this sickness. But I'm getting up some green and yellow stuff, so I'm assuming that is sinus infection. And I think I've said this during every sermon during this series, but each chapter seems to get harder to preach. And this one is a pretty hard one because there's so much going on here. And we're going to cover two chapters today in Daniel 11 and 12, but there's so much going on here that it's amazing to see, and I've said this during most of the sermons, so it's amazing to see how accurate this vision was for God's people and for what happened. And so what I'm going to do today, I have more slides than usual because that's the only way I could keep it straight, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to keep it straight because we're going to talk about a lot of this king, the first, and then the second, and then the third, and then the fourth, and it gets confusing, but this chapter of chapter 11, this vision, is one of the most exact fulfillments of prophecy. In fact, liberal scholars would say that this was written after the fact because it's so accurate. I was listening to a preacher, and he said, so in other words, in that case, a liberal scholar, liberal means wrong. They're a wrong scholar. And they are wrong. This was written before, but we see this come true in an amazing way. So we got to jump into it because there's a lot to cover and not a lot of time. So I'm already 3 minutes over. So let's go. We're going to start Daniel 11, verse 2. If you remember last week, Daniel 10, it was kind of the setup for this vision. And we went all the way through Daniel chapter 11, verse 1. Let's pick it up in verse 2. It says, now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth king will gain far more riches than all of them. And as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will stir up the entire empire against the realm of Greece. And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has risen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out towards the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, because his sovereignty will be removed and given to others besides them. So this is the angel speaking to Daniel, and he says, there are going to be three more kings that arise for Persia, but there will be one more, a fourth one, that will be far more powerful and rich than all of them. And his name was King Xerxes of Persia. He was a powerful king. If you want to read about him, you can read about him in the Bible, in the book of Esther. He was almost tricked into destroying the Jews. But this prophecy doesn't really deal with him too much, because then it goes into him saying there's going to be another king that will arise. Now, this king is going to be against Greece, but this new king, a mighty king, verse 3, will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. That would be Alexander the Great of Greece. We've covered him multiple times during these visions. He's come up time and time again. This time, when I was reading about him, I found a story that was very interesting to me. Alexander the Great, he's not going to be mentioned. We're getting ready to move right past him. We're getting ready to move right past these two. And the reason why is because the majority of this vision has to do with those that persecuted the Jews. Alexander the Great didn't really persecute the Jews. As powerful as he was, for some reason he didn't. And history tells us that he had received a vision or a dream. And in that dream, the being told him to go and wage war. And in that dream, he saw the high priest of the Jews. Well, the day before Alexander the Great was going to get to Jerusalem, the high priest is scared to death. Because, you know, he's afraid that this great and powerful king is going to come and ransack Jerusalem just like the rest of them had. And so he is praying, seeking God, and God gives him a vision and tells him to go meet Alexander the Great on the road before he gets to Jerusalem. So that's exactly what the high priest does. And he shows Alexander the Great the very book we're reading, Daniel, and tells him, about fell off right there, and tells him that you are the fulfillment of prophecy. You are the great one that's going to rise out of Greece. You are him. And so Alexander the Great is seeing a fulfillment of his vision. He is seeing that there is some credibility to Daniel and these visions that were given to Daniel. And so Alexander the Great decides to not persecute the Jews and instead allows them to continue to worship God because God had worked on their behalf. Really cool story on why Alexander the Great did not attack them. Verse 4 tells us that as soon as that king, talking about Alexander the Great, has risen, his kingdom will be broken up and divided out to the four points of the compass. So Alexander the Great didn't reign very long. At 32 years old, what I'll be turning this year, he developed a fever after a drunken party in Babylon and died. And as we have covered during this series, his kingdom was split up four different ways. Compass has four different directions. Although his kingdom, this prophecy tells us that his kingdom will not be divided to his own descendants, nor according to the authority in which he wielded. Instead, it will be given to others besides them. So he set up heirs. Well, the heirs didn't get the kingdom. He designated who would become kings. They would not. Instead, it was given to four different generals who would fight. And most of the remainder of this vision deals with two of those generals who inherited Alexander's kingdom and were following the dynasties that they established. And so I want to show you this map here. We're going to be looking at the Ptolemaic kingdom and the Seleucid Empire. And the easier way for me to think about it was Syria and Egypt. And that's because I got tired of saying those words. Syria and Egypt. So this was the empire, this was the empire, and this right here in the middle is Israel. Is where God's people were, Jerusalem. You can see Gaza on this list, Sidon, Tyre, Damascus. And so what happens when you're in the middle of two warring countries? You get caught in the middle. And so what we would see, I think it's for over 130 years, there are battles going on between these two empires, and whichever empire is the strongest is the one that is in control of Jerusalem and the Jewish people. The way that this vision talks, we'll be talking about the king of the south and the king of the north. So the king of the south represents Egypt. The king of the north represents Syria. So let's continue verses 5 through 6. Then the king of the south will grow strong, along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and rule. His domain will be a great realm indeed. And after some years, they will form an alliance. And the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north. So there we are introduced to the north and south. She will not keep her position of power, nor will he remain with his power. But she will be given up, along with those who brought her in, and the one who fathered her as well as who supported her in those times. So it introduces us to the kingdom of the south, the king of the south. The first king of the south is a man named Ptolemy the First. The first king of the north is Seleucus the First. And they are the ones who initially they're fighting. But as happened often then, when you're fighting, they wanted peace, and so what they decided was that the daughter of the king of the south, the daughter of Ptolemy the First, would come and marry the king of the north. Now, this has moved on to now the king of the north at this point is Antiochus II. You can see why this sermon's going to be confusing, because we got the second, we got the third, this should be the fourth, the V's missing. You got Ptolemy, the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. So just bear with me today. I'm going to try to keep it straight. Hopefully you can too. But the daughter of Ptolemy II marries Antiochus II. They wanted to create this peace. This is better than a soap opera, what happens here. Her dad then dies. So Ptolemy II dies. Well, the king of the north decides he don't want to be married to the daughter anymore. The peace agreement has ended. So he divorces her and gets back with his former wife. Well, his former wife, woman scorned, is angry. So what does she do? She kills him. So she kills Antiochus II. And then she decides she might as well go kill Ptolemy II's daughter. And so she goes down in the south, kills his daughter as well, kills their son, and all of her attendants, which is exactly what Scripture says will happen. Scripture told us the daughter of the king will come to the king of the north. They will reach agreement, but she will not keep her position of power, nor will remain with his power, but she'll be given up along with all of those who brought her in and all those who supported her as well. I can get maybe some people guessing what's going to happen in the future with certain countries, but to guess that this marriage arrangement would happen, that she wouldn't last very long, that's not a guess. That's God knowing the future, knowing exactly what was going to happen. And this was fulfilled. And so what she ends up doing is she ends up placing her son on the throne of the kingdom of the north. And so that would be Seleucus II. Let's continue on, verses 7 through 9. One of the descendants of her line, so here's referring to this daughter of the south. One of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come against the north's army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and prevail. This is talking about Ptolemy III. He was the brother of the sister that died here from his mother. From Seleucus' mother. So we see here that he went and avenged his sister's death. In verse 8 says, he will also take into captivity to Egypt their gods with their cast metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold. And he, on his part, will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. So there would be some peace in the middle of that. Verse 9, then the latter will enter the realm of the king of the south, but will return to his own land. So it's telling us the king of the north will try to attack the king of the south. Not going to happen. Is humbled and is turned back up north. All that took place. This happened when Ptolemy III invaded Syria and humbled Seleucus II. Let's continue on, verses 10 through 13. And his sons will mobilize, so this is the sons of the north, and they will assemble a multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, so that he may again wage war up to his fortress. And the king of the south will be enraged and will go out and fight with the king of the north. Then the latter will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be handed over to the former. When the multitude is carried away, his heart will be haughty, and he will cause tens of thousands to fall, yet he will not prevail. For the king of the north will again raise a greater multitude than the former, and after some interval of some years, he will press on with a great army and much equipment. So in other words, there's a lot of battling going back and forth. The sons of the north will assemble huge forces. They will pass through the Holy Land. They'll take it over from the south. And then the king of the south comes back. They take over. This was fulfilled when Antiochus III was defeated at the Battle of Raphia. And because of that loss, he was forced to give back dominion over the Holy Land to Ptolemy the fourth. So then the king of the north takes back over. So now we're on verses 14 through 16. Now in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people will also raise themselves up to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. Now let's just stop right there and explain this. The violent ones among your people. So he's talking about people within God's people, the Jews, people who are looking for violence. They, the Jews, if they had to be ruled by one or the other, neither was good, But they would much rather be ruled by the kingdom of the north than the kingdom of the south. The kingdom of the south, Egypt. I mean, I think about back to the Egyptian slavery they were in. They've already had bad blood with both of these countries, but specifically Egypt. And so they decide to join in, and they would help Antiochus III defeat the king of the south, which was Ptolemy V. And this was because the Jews hated the Egyptian rule. And so we see that they join in with the battle. Continue on. Then the king of the north will come, pile up an assault ramp, and capture a well-fortified city. And the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to make a stand. But he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land, which refers to that the promised land, with destruction in his hand. So the king of the north was welcomed by the Jewish people. Ultimately, he was a liberator from the Egyptian rule, but then he ended up ruling just as harshly as the Egyptians did. So you just see God's people are being handed back and forth between two warring countries, two warring kings. And this is what this prophecy is saying, and this is exactly what happened. So let's continue, verse 17. He will set his mind on coming with the power of his entire kingdom, bringing to him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. He will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it, but she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. So the king of the north wants to attack the southern kingdom, and this was fulfilled when Antiochus III gave his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy V. You probably are familiar with the term or the person Cleopatra. This is not the one you're familiar with. This was the first one. I think she's the third one or the second one, something like that. But it sort of sets her up later to be in rule power. But he gives his daughter, Cleopatra, to Ptolemy V of Egypt. He did this thing to gain permanent influence and eventually control in Egypt. Unfortunately, once again, soap opera, Cleopatra was not faithful to her Egyptian husband at all. So she just made her Egyptian husband angry, which made the war probably that much more violent. So continue on, verses 18 through 19. Then he will turn, this is talking about Antiochus, the kingdom of the north, will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many. This was fulfilled when he turned his attention to Asia Minor and Greece. But a commander will put a stop to his taunting against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his taunting. So he will turn his face towards the fortresses of his own land, but he will stumble and fall, not to be found. This happened when a Roman general defeated this Antiochus III in Greece. And Antiochus was wanting to humiliate Greece, but instead he was humiliated and he returned to his kingdom, but he died shortly after. In fact, the reason why he died was because he was so embarrassed and he had spent so much money that he had went to these Babylonian temples and pillaged the temples of these false gods, and it made the local citizens so angry that they killed him. Once again, we see prophecy coming true. He will stumble and fall and not be found. He was killed. Verse 20. Then in his place one will arise who will allow an oppressor to pass through the jewel of his kingdom, talking about the promised land. Yet within a few days he will be broken, though not in anger nor in battle. So this is referring to this guy. So now we're just focusing on the kingdom of the north. Seleucus III, and he only reigned very, very briefly. And the reason why he only reigned very briefly was because his brother probably assassinated him. And his brother is Seleucus III. I mean, his brother was Antiochus IV. Or you may remember him from previous sermons as Antiochus Epiphanes. This is the man that it was the foreshadowing of the Antichrist, we have flew through this first section because this is the main part, this area through here where we read what Antiochus does. We're told about Antiochus's rise to power in verse 21, and it's interesting how the angel describes Antiochus. He says this, "In his place a despicable person will arise, on whom the majesty of kingship has not been conferred," he took it, "but he will come in a time of tranquility, and he will seize the kingdom by intrigue. And the overflowing forces will be flooded away from him and smashed, also the prince of the covenant. After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers did not, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder, spoils, and possessions among them. He will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time." So he was very successful in what he did. He would go and he became rich. I mean, he did it in evil ways. Verses 25 through 26. "He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand because of schemes will be devised against him." Verse 26. "Those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain." Actually, this happened because Antiochus' own advisors betrayed him, and it caused him to lose this battle. Verses 27 through 28. "As for both kings, their heart will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table." Sounds like our politicians today. "But it will not succeed, because the end is still to come at the appointed time. Then he," referring to Antiochus the Fourth, "will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land." So in other words, what this is saying is his attention has turned to the Jewish people. We're told a little bit more why here in 29 through 31. "At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this last time it will not turn out the way it did before. For ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore, he will withdraw in fear and will return and curse the Holy Covenant and take action. He will pay back and pay attention to those who abandoned the Holy Covenant." So what happens here is Antiochus Epiphanes decides to attack Egypt again, but Egypt gets the help of Rome. In fact, Rome's navy is helping them out. And so Antiochus Epiphanes, while he was pretty successful in his battles, he was not in this one. And he runs away embarrassed. And if there's one thing that I've learned from Daniel is that you don't embarrass the king. And if you embarrass, the king gets embarrassed, there is going to be some type of payback. And so what happens is he comes home, or he comes back to the kingdom of the north from his loss to Egypt in the south, and he is angry. He is bitter. He is embarrassed. And he takes it out on harmless people, God's people, the Jews. And we're told in 31, "Forces from him will rise. They will desecrate the sanctuary fortress and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation." When someone who is very arrogant and powerful realizes they're not all that powerful, they then will try to exert power wherever they can. And that's exactly what happened here. He returns to Jerusalem. He tells them, you no longer can worship your God. In fact, this is when the abomination of desolation happens. We covered this another week, but we'll talk about it a little bit here. The abomination of desolation happens where he sets up a figure of Zeus in the holy temple where God is supposed to be. He sacrifices pigs on the altar, smears pig's blood all over the temple, just totally desecrates the temple, and basically spits in the Jews' face and saying, no, you don't worship Yahweh anymore. You worship our gods. You worship Zeus. He did all that because he was angry. Just a bad, bad, bad dude. And so it continues, verses 32 to 35. "And by smooth words he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly towards the covenant. But people who know their God will be strong and take action. Those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, but yet they will fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. So catch that there. Those who know God, know their God will be strong and they will take action. They will have insight among the people and will give understanding to many. I think those that are that have knowledge of the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation that are here when the tribulation period is here, I don't know if the rapture happens before or after, but whoever's here and knows Daniel, Revelation, they're going to be able to give a lot of people understanding of what's going to happen during that tribulation period. They're going to be able to tell a lot of people, this is what's going to happen. In fact, you're going to see today in Daniel 12, they're going to be able to tell them how many days it's going to be until Jesus returns once something specific happens, and we'll get to that in a second. But there were some Jews here that knew God, knew the Bible, and they were able to tell people exactly what was going on. And as you expect, when a king finds out there's people who know more than he does because they know someone greater than him, God, he's going to kill them. And so he's going to go after them. They will fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. Verse 34 and 5. Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join them with them in hypocrisy. And some of them who have insight will fall to refine and purge and cleanse them until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. That's probably a loaded verse right there, and we don't have time to cover it. But I will tell you this. In his attack on Jerusalem, Antiochus IV is said to have killed 80,000 Jews, taken 40,000 more as prisoners, and sold another 40,000 as slaves. He plundered the temple, robbing it of the gold and sacrifices and different things that people have brought to the temples over the years. And that the amount of money that he took from the Jerusalem temple adds up to about $1 billion today. Just robbing. That'd be like someone robbing the churches of $1 billion today. Now, from here on, there's a shift. It does not look like a shift if you just read through it, but there's a shift, and I'll tell you why. And we'll about to tell you why here in 36, but the shift happens from, we're talking about Antiochus the Fourth, to we're talking about the Antichrist. So starting in verse 36, the king will do as he pleases. He will exalt himself and boast against every god and will speak dreadful things against the God of gods. And he will be successful until the indignation is finished, because that which is determined will be done. We know this is switching from talking about Antiochus the Fourth to talking about the Antichrist, is because while Antiochus the Fourth did think he was a who's who, he did not set up himself in the temple to be worshipped. He set up an image of Zeus to be worshipped. The Antichrist is not going to do that. The Antichrist is going to set up an image of himself to be worshipped. He will exalt himself and boast against every god. He wants to be treated as God, the Antichrist will want to be. Verse 37, he will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will boast against them all. I have never heard this before, but one commentary I read said that when it says that he will show no desire for women, it could mean that the Antichrist is a homosexual. Now, the other translation and the more common interpretation of this says that he will have no regard for the gods of his father, so he's not going to care about any other god because he thinks he's God. And the desire of women, some scholars think refers to Jesus. And the reason why they think it refers to Jesus is because what they're saying is that women desire to carry Jesus, desire to be the mother of Jesus, so he would be the desire of women. I don't know. I'll go with smarter people on this who thinks it's that, but that could mean that the Antichrist will be a homosexual. I don't know. Just want to throw that out there, and you can interpret it how you want. He'll show no regard for any other god, and he will boast against them all. Instead, verse 38, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his father did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, precious stones, and treasure. Talking about honoring a god of fortresses, it's really referring to him waging war, making a god out of war even, and basically spending all he can to wage war against God's people and against other nations. Verse 39, he will take action against the strongest of forces with the help of a foreign god, and he will give great honor to those who acknowledge him and will make them rulers over the many and will parcel out land for a price. So he has the help of a foreign god. If you know anything from the book of Revelation, what we have in the book of Revelation is what's called the unholy Trinity. So we got the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. In the book of Revelation, they try to mirror that. They've got Satan, who would take the place of God the Father. They got the Antichrist, which would take the place of Jesus. And there is the prophet, the false prophet. There's going to be someone that rises that is going to encourage everybody to worship the Antichrist. That would represent the Holy Spirit. And so here we're saying he's going to do all this with the help of a foreign god. Who's that foreign god? His name's Satan. He wants to be worshipped as God. So he is going to empower the Antichrist to do great and mighty and powerful things. And even do things that we think is impossible. Like kill himself, be resurrected, quote unquote. He's going to have great power because the Satan is going to empower him. Let's continue on verses 40 through 45. At the end time, the king of the south will wage war with him. So that tells us Egypt is going to come back and they're going to attack the king of the north. The king of the north will storm against him with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. In this case, the king of the south may be Egypt. It also just may represent the Muslim countries, the Muslim community that's over there in the Middle East. The king of the north says the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. In this case, the king of the north may refer to the Antichrist and his domain. The king of the north here also could refer to Russia. And we're going to see this again here in a second. He will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand: Edom, Moab, and the foremost sons of the Ammon. Then he will reach out with his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. So that tells us exactly where the Antichrist is going to win some battles. But rumors from the east and from the north will terrify him. And he will go out with a great wrath to eliminate and annihilate many. Now, help me. What countries are to the north of Israel and what countries are to the east of Israel? Think about world powers today. To the east, what would it be? China. And China's becoming very quickly the world power. To the north could represent Russia, could represent, I think it could represent the European countries, the NATO alliance eventually coming against the Antichrist. I don't know. Some people think the Antichrist might come out of the European Union, so we don't know. But there's some countries from the north that have scared the Antichrist, and there's countries from the east that have scared the Antichrist. And they're going to start coming towards Jerusalem for this battle to take place. And yet, he's still going to go out with a great wrath. He will annihilate many. Verse 45, he will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. This is referring to the Battle of Armageddon that you probably have heard about. At the Battle of Armageddon, millions of people will perish. The word Armageddon actually means the Mount of Megiddo, and it refers to a location that's 60 miles north of Jerusalem where that final battle will take place. That is in the book of Revelation, I believe. Those rumors from the east and the north, we don't know who they are, but probably Asian countries and some type of alliance from the north, they're going to scare the Antichrist. Eventually, the Antichrist is going to be destroyed. And we know Jesus comes back and handles business pretty quickly. So now we're going to go to Daniel chapter 12, and I'm going to skip the first four verses, and we'll come back to them at the end because I think they're powerful. We're going to skip to verses 5 through 9. It says, "Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, two others were standing, one on this bank on the stream and the other on that bank on the stream." So now he's back into real time, and he is standing at the river, and he sees two others standing there. "Someone said to the man dressed in linen," referring to the angel, "who was above the waters of the stream, 'How long will it be until the end of these wonders?' And I heard the man dressed in linen, who was above the waters of the stream, as he raised his right hand and his left towards heaven, and swore by him who lives forever, that it would be for a time, times, and half a time. And as soon as they finished smashing the power of the holy people, all of these events will be completed." So we're told some specific details here. We're told a time, times, and half a time. That is referring to 3.5 years. Time would be 1, times would be 2, 1 plus 2 is 3, and a half is 3.5. This is referring to 3.5 years, which is also recorded elsewhere. Verse 8. "But as for me, I heard but did not understand." So Daniel doesn't understand what's being said. It says, "My Lord, what will be the outcome of these events?" And the angel says, "Go your way, Daniel, for these words will be kept secret and sealed up until the end time." Verses 10 through 13. "Many will be purged, cleansed, and refined." We've already seen that in Daniel 11 too. That's that verse that I noted earlier. The only way that people are purged, cleansed, and refined is through the power and blood of Jesus Christ. And so this is referring in an indirect way that Jesus is going to come and change things, and people are going to be cleansed through the power of his blood. But then, and I know it's referring to that because, look, it's contrasted with wickedness. It says, "But the wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand, and those who have insight will understand." So elsewhere in the scripture, it tells us that wickedness will increase. And we're seeing that happen today. I think we're getting closer and closer to the end of this age. Verse 11, "And from that time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up." So he is telling us that from the moment that the Antichrist sets himself up in the temple, the abomination of desolation. So this tells me right here, the abomination of desolation happened with Antiochus IV, but it's also going to happen again with the Antichrist when he sets himself up in the temple to be worshipped, probably smears pig's blood all over the temple, just desecrates the temple again. This is telling us that after that, there will be 1,290 days. What an exact prophecy for us. 1,290 days, but blessed is the one who is patient and attains to the 1,335 days. But as for you, go your way to the end, then you will rest and rise for your allotted portion at the end of the age. So, it's telling us that from the point of the abomination of desolation, there's going to be a times, time, and half a time. He's referred to 3.5 years. 1,290 days, using the old calendar, is 3.5 years, exactly 3.5 years plus 30 days. What happens in those 30 days? We don't know. It could be that during those 30 days, that is when he is judging the nations, when Jesus is giving out judgments, or that might come later. We don't really know. I got some theories here, and we'll cover them in a second. Let me cover the 1,260 days. So Daniel 9:27, we've already read this when we did this sermon a couple weeks ago, tells us that the Antichrist will confirm a covenant with the many for 1 week. And if you remember, a week represents 7 years. In the middle of the week, he'll put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. So that tells us 3.5 years. So we have double confirmation here, Daniel 9 and Daniel 12, confirming that it's 3.5 years. So it's extra 30 days here. Some have suggested that maybe during those 30 days is when Jesus is assigning us our positions in the millennial reign. You will reign with Christ. We will judge the angels. Right now, the angels are above us. Well, in some ways, they serve us. But one day, we'll judge the angels. Our hierarchy will be even higher. We'll be more powerful than them. It might be that there's this judgments going on. There's time frame. We don't know. But what's interesting here is that there's another 45 days after the 30 added on to that. So 3.5 years would be 1260, 30 days. There's 1335, 1,335 days listed here. What happens in those extra 45 days? One suggestion says that this is when the judgment of the sheep and the goats takes place. You can read about that in Matthew 25, verses 31 through 34. The Son of Man will come in his glory and all the angels with him. He will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him. He'll separate them one from another, just as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He'll put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. And he will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." That might take the full 75 days. I don't know. Maybe he judges the righteous the first 30 days and the wicked the next 45 days. Because there's going to be more wicked than righteous, I think. I don't know. But there's this judgment that is going to take place, and I've got to think it happens during this time period because Jesus is saying, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom." So right then he's saying, come on in the kingdom. Here's the kingdom. Here's what I've created for you. Here's what it is. Come and enjoy it. Some say during this 30 days, I'm just remembering this. Some say during this 30 days, because of all the war that has been taking place, it takes 30 days to rebuild Jerusalem just to be presentable. And then the 45 days is the judgment that takes place. That could be true too. This judgment is going to take place. Whether it takes place here or wherever, this judgment is going to take place. And so, you know, my question for us today, it's always hard to get a, it's cool to learn all these facts and all the fulfillment of this prophecy, but when I'm preaching in a sermon, I want to have a takeaway for you that you can take away with you this week. And so the takeaway that I've got for you is, how do we make sure we're on the right side of this judgment? Because the alternative is this. He will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you accursed people, into the eternal fire, which has been prepared for the devil and his angels." I want to make sure I'm on the right side, not the left side. I want to make sure that I'm going to be on the side that inherits the kingdom and not the side that's going to be sent to hell. That's your only two choices. And it depends on how you live now on which side you will be on. Let's go back to the beginning of Daniel 12. We'll go back to those verses we skipped. "So at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people," remember Michael's the angel, the archangel that's over Israel, "he will arise, and there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued." What book is he referring to? He's referring to the book of life. Tells us that everyone's name who is written in the book will be rescued. You're not getting rescued if you're not written in the book. If you've not come to faith in Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior and living for Him, you're not getting rescued. You have nothing but hell to look forward to. And you're not going to look forward to that. Verses 2 through 4, "And many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake. These to everlasting life, but others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. And those who have insight will shine like the glow of the expanses of heaven." That's telling us those who know what's going on, they're going to shine. "And those who lead the many to righteousness will shine like the stars forever and ever. But as for you, Daniel, keep these words secret and sealed up the book until the end of time. many will roam about, and knowledge will increase. So he's telling us, your name has to be written in the book. And he's foreshadowing here this resurrection that would take place that Paul talks about. That one day we will sleep, but we will all be resurrected. We will see people coming out of the ground resurrected and being judged. So it doesn't matter. You might breathe your last breath today. If you die and you're going to get put in the ground, you are going to be resurrected one day. The question is, are you going to be resurrected to everlasting life or to everlasting contempt and destruction and disgrace? That's your only two choices. And what the angel tells Daniel, the only thing that matters is if your name is written in the book. In other words, is if you are a follower of Jesus. That is how you get your name written. And so my job, I think, as the pastor of this church in Seagrove, is to make sure that your name is written in the book. To make sure that you have repented of your sins, that you are following Jesus this morning, because you're not guaranteed the next minute. You're not guaranteed to make it home safely today. And so you might be thinking, I can wait to come to faith in Jesus. I can wait to get my life straight. I can wait to do all of this. And all Jesus is saying is, come. You don't have to get your life straight, then come to Jesus to get your name written in the book. Instead, you get your name written in the book, and he'll make your life straight. Because you're one of his children. You're one of his people. And he'll rescue you at the end of the age. I'm going to throw a curveball to the worship team. Worship team, come on back up. We're going to sing the Worthy song again. Because, that song says, who else is worthy? There's nobody. Are you living that way? Because wherever your focus is, it's telling us who you think is worthy. Is it you? Therefore, you're doing everything you want to do in life. Is it someone else? And so you're living for them? Or is it God? No one else can write your name in that book. You can worship every human being on this planet. You can worship the President of the United States. You can live for this world. And nobody in this earth can write your name down in the book. Therefore, you are headed for disgrace and destruction. The only person that can write your name in the book is Jesus. And Jesus is here right now. Jesus is present. And Jesus wants you to know that he loves you. And he wants you to come to him. So if you will, stand to your feet. Every head bowed and every eye closed. And I want to give us this opportunity today as we finish up this series called Faithful. And while the focus of this series is how God is faithful, I think about how he calls us to be faithful.